Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another tangent. My name is Ben Mowell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all. What's the action?
What is the action? If someone ever has an answer for that, I'd love to hear it. Haven't heard one yet.
Neither have I. I'm very disappointed.
But we are glad you've joined us today on Tangential Banter. And to kick things off, I have just a little bit of a funny anecdote, not a tangent per se, but as you regular listeners are aware, Jack and I both work for the company. And the company possesses an office space that's rather large with many people sitting in cubicles. And I was sitting in my cubicle today. And what should my wondering eyes behold? Except this flash just that I kind of caught out of the side of my eye, corner of my eye. And I look over and there's a bird flying around in the office. And I was like, leaned over to my teammate and I was like, did you see that? There's a bird flying around in here. And he's like, no way. And then kind of looked up and it had flown away by that point. But then probably half a dozen times over the next 60 to 90 minutes, the bird like flew back from around a corner down our aisle, and then it was like walking around on the floor. And at one point I walked over to where it was and I thought I heard it like rummaging in a trash can before it flew away. Yeah, and then a little bit later, so this started like this whole conversation in the aisle, and then you just hear people walking around the building like, did you see the bird? My manager had asked if anybody had topics for our team meeting today, and the bird came up as the topic. And he ended up giving us an update. His wife also works for the company, and apparently the bird had like hit a window and become stunned.
Oh.
And so someone in her group picked up the stunned bird and took it back outside.
Oh, that's good of them.
So assuming that the bird wanted to be back outside, not like a house bird sort of situation. But
huh. What do you know about, what was it, just like a sparrow or a robin or something?
It was, I'm not a bird expert. I do know a fair bit about bird law, though.
Yeah, of course, naturally.
Yeah. But the individual bird species themselves, I don't know a ton. But it was a small bird with black feathers, like maybe the size of a grackle, kind of.
I don't know what a grackle was.
But so there's like, I think grackles are in the same family as like crows. There's like ravens are the big scavenger blackbird. And then there's ravens, crows, grackles. Grackles might be the smallest.
Huh.
Anyway, it was like, I don't know, like 2/3 the size of a football, maybe.
Oh, dang. So it wasn't small. I mean, it wasn't like a little bird. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that was like nose to, or beak to tail, kind of. Not like it was actually that, filled out that much volume.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know, what, 8 inches, 8 inches long.
You shared with me that some point in the previous or sometime in the recent past at the company in the same building that a feral cat had been found inside one of the testing rooms and had bitten a couple people. So like when you said there was a bird, you know, I'm thinking, well, first you told me about the bird and then you told me about the cat. So I was thinking they could have killed two birds with one stone. Pun intended, or maybe we should say they could have killed one bird with one cat if they just got the cat and then let it loose to catch the bird, and you'd solve two problems. Like one problem,
especially if the bird flew outside first. It's like a Sylvester and Tweety sort of paradigm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, maybe the cat's hanging around the building because they're, plentiful and easily available birds or something.
Must be. You know, when I was in college, we had a computer lab that a lot of the students in my major would use. And normally throughout the year, it was just packed. Like you couldn't find a computer to use most of the time because all of them were taken up. But my last semester in college was actually a summer semester, which sounds lame, but it was actually awesome because I had not a full semester's worth of class work. Like I just needed to finish up like three classes, and one of them was like only met once a week. And so it was really easy. But I went up to the computer lab one day and it was just barren because it's summer and all the windows were open too. And they didn't have screens because it was up on the third floor. You don't really need screens, at least to prevent people from breaking in and out.
Is that what screens are typically for?
I don't know. Well, maybe they're also to keep wildlife out, in which case this computer lab would have benefited from screens because this day when all the windows opened, there was just a bird flying around the computer lab.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, how picturesque. A bird just living its life. The college students taking an easy summer semester. And it was a very lazy summer day.
That
That'll
reminds
be
me.
four years, that are 10 years ago this summer, actually. Oh, bringing
Wow.
back memories.
I like that you started to say 4 years and then jumped to 10. Like it's a
Well,
very
I was
different.
gonna say like it's gonna be, why was I thinking? Yeah, wait, yeah, why did four come up? Maybe because
Because
it's
it's 2024 or
yeah, 20.
2014.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Like in 2024, it will have been 10 years. So I was about to
Yeah.
say in 2010, it will have been 4 years. I'm like, wait, that doesn't make sense.
Oh, that reminds me. I just learned a new term the other day. Oh, what was it called?
Flurgensau.
No, it was. I'll I can't look it up now. I will make a note, mental note to find it and come back to it. Maybe I'll put it in the description or in the title, like we've done with some of the other questions that we figured out later. But the story I was going to share is, when I went to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in 2014, we got to our hotel in Arusha, Tanzania. And the hotel had a sign at the check-in desk that was like, basically, if you leave your windows open, your room will have monkeys in it trying to steal your stuff. So
Whoa.
don't leave your windows open. It was pretty funny. It was like, this is, it was the first sign that we were in a very, well, not the first sign, but one of the first signs that we were in a very, very different place than we were used to.
Right. Huh. That's hilarious.
Yeah, so.
Did you see any monkeys like just prowling around when you were there?
Actually, not at the hotel, but they were all over. It, like, you know, when you're driving around the Midwest, you're not at all surprised to see like a rabbit or a skunk or something. You know what I mean? Just like all these little critters.
Yeah.
That's the way that like baboons are, at least where
Whoa.
we were. They were just roaming around the countryside like pests, kind of. They were in place, they were in town in places. It just kind of reminded me of like their version of raccoons, where they kind of, you try to avoid them in general. But then, you know, here we are as tourists, like, oh, baboon, that's so awesome. It'd be like if somebody showed up here and was like, oh man, a raccoon, look at that thing. Taking pictures of it, and you're just like, yeah, it's a raccoon, you know.
How neat is that?
That's pretty neat.
That's pretty neat.
You know, and I think what you think to yourself in that situation is, hey, Mr. Bear, I think you're pretty neat, but I respect your distance.
That's right.
The term that I was thinking of, I still haven't remembered it, but it was a term to describe when you're trying to make a statement and you transpose part of each word into the other word.
A portmanteau?
No, so a portmanteau is like you take two words and smash them together and it becomes a new word.
Okay.
This was like a, I think it was like a Greenbergism or something. Green, Greenerism or something like that. It was named after a person. But it would be like saying, like a false start, for example, if you said Stahl's fart, or you know
I'm going to totally start using that term. It was a Stahl's fart.
I mean? But it's like where your brain knows what it's trying to say, but like gets ahead of itself and starts to insert part of the second word into the first and then flips the other one around.
Yes. Or when you think two separate things and then end up saying them both mashed together. Like we've gone over that before. Like when my friend held the door open for someone and when they thanked him, he meant to say no problem and yep at the same time. So they were just like, oh, thank you. Nope.
Yep, that's pretty much exactly it. And I'm really annoyed that I can't remember what that is. But anyway, we'll move on. We do have a larger discussion topic for today, Jack, that you proposed. So why don't you introduce us to the topic and give us your preliminary stance or take?
Yeah, so I might get some of the numbers mixed up because I didn't. I think the last time I watched it was based on the topic's based on a YouTube short by, I believe the channel name is Three Blue One Brown or Three Brown One Blue. Can't remember which. And they do a lot of like number, mathematics, science, stuff. And I don't know what if this sh YouTube short was based off of a larger video, but
It
they.
is.
Oh, have you seen that larger video?
I started to watch it and then got bored, so
I needed that.
I know that's not a rousing endorsement for the topic, but
so
the short is good. Short is good.
yeah, so the short is it exemplifies that one a topic that I think comes up a lot where you can. You, where a lot of things in this world are unintuitive and seemingly irrational to the point where if you applied logic to it, then you would be wrong because our logic is less robust than we think it is. So this is the phenomenon. So it's really this topic is a manifestation of a greater topic that I've been interested in last handful of years. So
Do
the
do
YouTube
do do do. Phenomena.
phenomenon, do. The this is what the short says. Let's suppose, and again, I'm probably gonna get some of the numbers wrong, but the general gist I'm gonna try to capture. Let's suppose that 1% of the population is currently afflicted with a certain disease or condition. Let's call it Flargenstau. So 1% of the people have Flargenstau. 99% of the population does not. Now let's suppose there's a test to detect Flargenstau that is 90% accurate. So, or maybe it's proposed that it's 90% accurate. And let's say that if you take a population of people with this Flargenstau disease, 90% of the time you're going to get a correct positive, where the test says, yes, person with Flargenstau, you have Flargenstau. So 90% of the time, if somebody with Flargenstau takes this test, it will correctly say that they have it. 10% of the time, it'll be a false negative. So the test is 90% accurate. Similarly, if you take a population of people without the affliction, the test will 90% of the time indicate the correct result that they don't have Flargenstau. 10% of the population, it'll give a false positive saying that they do, but it's still 90% accurate. Okay, so the setup is point one, 1% of the population has this Flargenstau disease. Point two is that it's 90% accurate. So if you take a population of people with the disease, 90% of those tests will correctly indicate that they have it. And point three is it's also 90% accurate for those who don't have it, where 90% of the time it'll correctly say that they they don't. Now, let's say, as in any real situation, that you don't really know if you have it or not. All you have is the test to go by. Now, let's say you take a population of, see, and this is where I get fuzzy on what the numbers were exactly. I think
they used
it was
a population of 1,000.
Of 1,000, right? So, use it. So you take a population of 1,000 people, and you give them all the test. The test is 90% accurate, which let's say you've determined by you take 90% of the people that you know don't have Flargenstau, and you run the test, and you find out 90% of the time the test correctly says that they don't. Then you do the same for people who you know are positive. But if you take a population of, let's say, 1,000 people who you don't know if they have it, and you give them the test, it's something like the test is only accurate 11% of the time, because only 1% of that population, on average, if you do this this batch of testing over and over again, the rate of Flargenstau is only 1%. So of those 1,000 people, only 10% of them have Flargenstau. And the test is 90% accurate, so probably 9 of them are going to get a correctly positive result. 9 of the 1,000. Then one of the 1,000 is going to get a false negative. But then the other, 990 people don't have Flargenstau, but the test is going to show, because it's 90% accurate, 10% inaccurate, it's going to show that what is 10% of 990, so 99 of them have Flargenstau. It's going to falsely tell you that 99 people who don't actually have Flargenstau have it. So at the end of the day, after these 1,000 tests, you're getting 9 plus 99 positive results. Now, remember, you don't know which ones are true positives or false positives. You just know that you've gotten 99 positives. So what are the odds that if you are one of the people who got a positive result, that you actually have it, as opposed to you're one of those who got a false negative? So even though the test is 90% accurate, only, I think it's like 1 out of 11 people who got a positive result will actually end up, it actually turns out that they have it. So in that respect, the test is only 1/11th accurate. So which is it? Is the test 90% accurate? Or like, what is that? What's 1/11th? Like 8.8% accurate. Is it 8.8%? Something like that. 9% accurate, let's say. Maybe it's 9.1 or something. But anyway, it's like, which metric do you use to determine accuracy? Because they're both correct. And the thing is, if whichever metric you use to determine accuracy, that metric is not going to be a good decision, a good metric, depending on the context. Mm-hmm. So which one is it? And maybe, right, if you hear that a test is somewhat, 90% accurate or 99% accurate, just because you get a positive result or a negative result, how confident can you actually be that you have the disease that it's testing for, or the condition? Are you one of those, 9 out of 1,000 people who have a correctly positive result, or are you the one of the 99 out of 1,000 people, which is a much greater population, to have a false positive result? So just because you hear, right, that a test is 9% accurate and you get a positive result, odds are you probably don't have it, which is really unintuitive.
Yep.
That's the thing, is like, even if a test is 90% accurate and you get a positive result, it can be said that odds are you don't have it.
Well, given those parameters, right?
Right. So obviously, test accuracy is a knob that can be played with, and the percentage of the population that has this, whatever condition you're testing for, is a knob to play with. So I would guess, let's say the test is 99% accurate and 30% of the population may have this condition. The test, accuracy is probably going to be more accurate to the real scenario of whenever you get a test, you don't know which population you're in. I think the short used fairly extreme values. Not, I wouldn't even say fairly extreme. I think a 90% accurate test is actually on the lower end. Which might actually be, well, but it's not extremely low. Like a 90% accurate test, I would say that's in the ballpark of realistic. 1% of the population is probably in the ballpark of being realistic, but I'm, that factor varies very wildly. It varies very wildly. Huh.
Say it varies wildly.
Well, it varies VAR.
Yeah. Yes.
Very VER wildly. Oh, I love the English language.
But wildly is already an adverb with extreme connotations.
That's a good point.
So to put very in front of it is kind of redundant.
Redundant, right?
A couple things it makes me think of is number one, the difficulty in establishing what the actual predictive capability of a test is like that is immense. Because you're using the term accuracy, when you start to dig into the statistics of it, accuracy isn't really a number that would be used. It'd be more like the specificity and the sensitivity. And there are a lot of like positive predictive value and likelihood ratio, something like that. I'm forgetting all the different terms, but there's a lot of different ways you can parse it. But also, like every test is a balance between false positives and false negatives, in a sense. Like you basically want to be able to catch everyone who actually has the disease, that they get a heads up, like, hey, you need to take some action without giving a false alarm and, all this extra unnecessary headache to very many people. And so one of the things I was reading earlier is that you kind of, because you have these two things that you're trying to control, false positives, false negatives, you essentially end up with what, by necessity, especially for more serious illnesses, has to be a two-tiered approach. So a screening test and then a confirmation test, in which the screening test would be designed such that it minimizes false negatives. So in essence, you're very confident you're going to catch everyone who actually has it, and you're probably going to catch a few people who don't, but you're not going to miss anyone who actually has this illness. Flaugenstein or whatever.
Flurgenstau. I can't remember exactly
Flaugenstein. So that would be the screening one. So it's like you don't miss anybody who has it, but you get more, you're going to end up saying more people have it than actually do. But then with that, once you have that subpopulation pulled out with the screening test, you would then give them a confirmation test, which is highly tuned to not give false positives. So you by using a two-tiered approach, you can eliminate the vast majority of the uncertainty in that situation or that scenario you just described. And so you can end up with a very high confidence that you have correctly identified the people who need treatment and not any more when you go through that two-tier approach. I thought that was pretty interesting.
If you have a test, so if you use a screening test that is tuned for not getting false negatives, then that means, I think, inherently that it has to sacrifice, or that the cost to that is that it will have noticeably higher false positives, as you said. So it'll catch, ideally, all the people that actually have it, have this Flurgenstau, but it's also going to catch a non-negligible population of people who don't have it. So when you give them the confirmation test and it's highly tuned to not give false positives, that means that it's inherently going to give a non-negligible amount of false negatives. But that means that there could be a lot of people, a non-negligible population, that actually made it past the screening test and do have it, but then are shown, or that then get a negative result in the confirmation test.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly true, I think.
Which would be really sucky if you actually have it and you go through two tests and the conclusion is that you don't have it. So then you walk away only to realize, oh, shoot, I've been dying of this disease this whole time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the point that was made in the videos and in all the literature is like the tests in a vacuum, you would maybe walk away. But if your second test comes back negative, but you have symptoms, right, of any kind, then you would continue testing. If you don't have symptoms, maybe you do walk away for a period of time and then you come back when symptoms present themselves or something, you know. It's not really usually in a vacuum where you're just going on the test result. Like, most people don't walk into, I don't know, get tested for malaria just because, and then go, huh, test came back positive, I must have it. But I don't think it's a perfect method, but that's one of the things that this whole counterintuitive, maybe not counterintuitive, but unintuitive result kind of highlighted for me, is that it's not nearly as cut and dried as we would think. And I can't remember if it was I think it was maybe in the long video, they basically posed this exact scenario to like doctors and medical professionals at a conference, and like something like 90% of them incorrectly or intuited incorrectly what the actual predictive capability of the test was. So it's not just lay people, it's even those who are trained in the profession. Now, they're not statisticians, right? So maybe that's just because they're familiar with the subject matter doesn't mean they're familiar with the Bayes law behind it, or principle, I can't remember what it is. But anyway, it gets everybody. And so I think the result is an overconfidence in the predictive capability of a screening test.
Which gets to the higher point I was mentioning earlier, that our logic is, I would say, shockingly less adequate than we give it credit to, or give it credit for, because the fact that the people that deal with this sort of stuff every day didn't realize this very, what I would call very shocking, very shocking conclusion. Because if you take the, remember, if you go back, if we go back to the numbers involved, of there's a, we believe about 1% of the population will get Flurgenstau. We test 1,000 people, and we believe that the test we're using is 90% accurate. And we test 1,000 people. There's going to be, we've already established that there's going to be, in this example, 9 true positives and 99 false positives. So that's a total of 108 positives coming out of this test. Now, remember, we don't know that those 108, of the results, we don't know which ones are true positives, false positives, true negatives, false negatives. We just know that we tested 1,000 people. We have 108 positive results. That's what we know. And we also know that we're pretty confident the test is 90% accurate and that 1% of the population has this disease. Now, if you just kind of go with those, if you don't really look beyond or look between the lines, you might then prescribe 108 people with treatment or with prescription medicine that they don't need and perhaps could even be harmful to them. Because imagine, right, if like 108 people are tested for cancer, say, oh, crap, we got to get you into chemo and radiation right away. Now you're poisoning them and radiating perfectly healthy people, and you're probably going to cause cancer at that point. Now, I'm not saying that this is how cancer treatment works or necessarily, but it's, you know, humor me here, right? If because I'm sure there's a situation like this where we assume, well, 90% of the people of these 108 folks probably have the disease. So that's around, you know, that's over 90 people. In reality, it's 9 people. So there's 80 some people that are going to be getting treatment that not only that they don't need, but might actually be hurting them.
Yeah.
But then we're going to say, oh, but science says 90% of these people have the disease. No, science does not say that. That's our misapplication of science and logic. Even though we can't find a flaw in that logic, that doesn't mean that one isn't there. Because I would imagine, right, you get 108 positives. The intuitive thing is to say, well, the test is 90% accurate. Therefore, of these 108, it's safe to say that 90% of them are true positives and 10% of them are false positives. That's a pretty intuitive train of thought, even though this YouTube short and what we've described, if you actually think about it, no, that's not what a 90% accurate test would display. It would unintuitively say that less than 10% of that population is actually a false positive, or excuse me, actually a true positive.
Yeah, I was trying to do the math in my head just now of what, because essentially the outcome of that is even with the 90%, just using the term accuracy, 90% accurate test, if you have a positive within this scenario, your odds are 1 in 11 that you actually, even with a positive test, your odds are 1 in 11 that you actually have that floop and flop.
Flargenstow. Right. Now, that 1 in 11, just for our reader's edification, that's specific to the numbers in this example.
Correct.
If you were to change the accuracy of the test or the percentage of the population that actually has it, prevalence, then it's going to, that 1 in 11 true accuracy is actually going to change.
Yeah. So then on the flip side, though, if you get a negative test, there's only, I was trying to run the math and I wasn't doing a good job of it, but if you get a negative test, your odds are much higher that you're actually negative, right? Because there's only one false negative versus a 800 and some true negatives.
Right. There's one false negative, and there's what? 810. So it's 90% of, 90% of 990. Ooh, let's do the math. Well, it's 810 for the 90% of 900. 810 and then 81. So 891. There's 891 true negatives and one false negative. So you're right. If you get so the flip side to this is this 90% accurate test is if you get a negative result, the accuracy is actually 891 out of 892, which is 99.9% accurate.
Right. So the good news is if you test negative, you can feel pretty comfy walking off into the sunset without worries that something was missed.
Mm-hmm.
The other thought that this gave me, a couple connected thoughts here, but one of them is it's got to be so, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but it's got to be so ridiculously hard to figure out the actual rate of prevalence in a population because you have all this testing error and knowing where you had false positives, true positives, false negatives, true negatives, etc.
Right.
There's you got to like triangulate on it with multiple test types or something. I don't know. I'm sure there's you can do some fancy math and get pretty confident, but given how quickly everything happened with COVID and this scenario, I also wonder how different the numbers we measured are from actuality, right? If
Right.
we had these magic goggles where we could actually see the COVID virus and who had it and who didn't, just walking around, it could be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then compare those against their test results, of how realistic our numbers were.
Yeah. I mean, you said it like there is probably some crafty mathematical tricks to actually get a pretty darn accurate calculation of what the true prevalence is. However, now I would suspect that that would require multiple tests slash even multiple testing methods where you deliberately use tests that have different accuracies so that when you compare their
Right.
results, you can see how the number of positives and negatives change relative to what the percentages their accuracy percentages are. Because again, we've already established in this example that a 90% accurate test will actually for any amount of population for a 90% accurate test and a 1% prevalence rate, you will for if a given population picked at random, you will actually get about, what was it, 10.8% positives. So
10.8% true positives, right?
no, that's po it's 108 positives. So that includes the false and the negatives.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then if you do like a, okay, now we're going to do a test that's, instead of 90, maybe 95 or eight, maybe as low as like 75% accurate. And then you see how the amount of positives per population changes. And it won't, it probably won't change proportionally. It'll change in a quite a weird way. And I bet that that weird way would help you determine what the actual prevalence rate is. However, not only do you have to, well, that would help you pinpoint what the prevalence rate is, but you would have to know what the test accuracy is ahead of time. And that would also require, unlike I think what we saw with COVID, that would require multiple tests per person, or maybe multiple different testing methods. That were then take, you had different populations for each one. Now, I think there were different methods used for COVID. I can't remember. There probably were. So maybe that is a decent example to use.
Well, and going back to what you were talking about earlier, of like if you use that approach and say you've got 108 positives, and then your second test is tuned to eliminate false positives, that you would necessarily under measure true positives. But in that population of 108, in this scenario, we know there are 9 who actually have it. And the fact that it's tuned to not give false positives means that the vast majority of those who would be weeded out would be true, were false negatives the first time around, right? And so let's just say, for the sake of argument, that you have maybe one person who is a true positive that gets weeded out. In the whole, I mean, it's not obviously not pleasant for that one person, but you would then end up with, out of that entire population of 1,000, two people who were, after two tests, misdiagnosed, right? Which I think is a pretty impressive feat. Because there's 80% of the people who have this illness are correctly diagnosed and getting the treatment that they should be, presumably. And then there's two people who have it who. No, wait. One of those 10. Yeah, one of the 10 was a false negative, right? Right out of the gate. And then there's another false negative in the second test. I don't know. The point I was making is that you could structure it in such a way that the vast majority of people are getting the appropriate action or non-action. And there are always going to be some cases that get the wrong result if
Right.
that's the only information that you have to go on, which is why they do lots of tests and why you have to describe your symptoms 6 times every time you go in. Were there other unintuitive scenarios that you had in mind, or was it just that test example?
I don't have, I think, a lot to bring up about this topic, or maybe I only think that, but what happens in cases where we're dealing with infinities of stuff, I think is a, because of this one, what I just described, where human intuition, or there are things that we can observe that are very counterintuitive and say, oh wow, I never would have come to that conclusion, that a 90% accurate test could really only have about a 10%, accurate result, based on, the context of the situation. When it comes to like discussing infinities, like if the universe is infinitely big, then X, Y, and Z, or infinitely old, then X, Y, and Z. I think we have to be really careful about, or if anything's infinitely big, old, long, heavy, I don't know, any quantity, you're gonna start seeing some weird behavior, very counterintuitive stuff that we can't apply known logic to, because that logic will not apply. So, I don't know, like there's the classic example of how if you take, it can be mathematically shown that if you start with, 1 + 2 + 3 + 4, and you go up to infinity, which is kind of a weird way of putting it, if you do that, if you sum that infinite sum, you would think we would get positive infinity, that the sum would just keep growing and growing and growing. And if you stop at any finite number, it will just be a ridiculously large sum. But if you go to infinity, the resulting sum is negative 1/12. And of course, that doesn't make sense for a couple of different reasons. One, my minor in mathematics says that the addition operation is closed, or the ring of natural numbers and the addition operator is closed, if I'm remembering my terminology right. Oh, there might be mathematicians in the audience that are just going to want to hound me for saying this wrong. But basically, if you take any two positive numbers, positive integers like 1, 37, 542, and you add them together, you're going to get another positive integer, right? Pretty intuitive. You can't add 1 + 3 and get 4.5, for example. Also, you can't add two positive integers and get a negative number. You can't add 3 + 14 equals -7. But this infinite sum breaks both of those rules. Rules that to any human being that has anything greater than like a fourth grade education knows are concrete 100% of the time. Yet they've also shown that no, it isn't. That you can essentially add positive integers to the point where the sum becomes negative and even becomes a non-integer, becomes a fraction. And that doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to interject here to remind the audience that we have committed to not fact-checking ourselves. So if you're find yourself listening to this and you're like, that's unbelievable, and you decide to go Google and you have all the information to prove Jack wrong, that's totally fine. That's just not the premise of the show.
Right.
So this isn't like spouting off something stupid for that sake. This is what we believe to be true in the moment and are debating about without external sources.
So the thing that really got me on this particular topic, like the sum of the positive integers, is that there is a YouTube channel called Numberphile, which I love, and that just deals about like numbers and math and stuff. And one of the things they go over is this infinite sum. And the thing, like at first, the way that they proved that the sum of all natural numbers is minus a 12th, it just seems like some mathematical hocus pocus that it's, you know, almost sleight of hand. Like it's hard for your layperson to detect where the error is, but surely there's one in there. But then one of them said that this fact, or this quote fact, that all infinite, like if you sum of all natural integers is a negative 12th, is used in string theory and has even, I don't understand the mechanics of it, but has somehow been observed in quantum studies or something about subatomic stuff. They can somehow this infinite sum comes up experimentally, and they've confirmed that it's true. As much as I don't really know what that means. I'm taking them at their word, and I haven't really dug into it. And even if I did, I probably wouldn't understand it. But these aren't like some crazy YouTube conspiracy guys. These are like professors at, like math professors at Cambridge that are saying this. So, right, it may sound ridiculous, right? But then if it's ridiculous, then the people at the tippy top of our academia are wrong, which isn't good. Or the people at the tippy top of our academia are right, and this crazy conclusion is true, which is also not great. So
well,
it's like,
I would,
damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of thing.
I would push back and say that if people at the tippy top, and I wouldn't just limit it to academia, but if the experts in a given field, academic, industry, whatever, if they're wrong, you said that's bad. And I would argue that's not bad. I would say experts historically are wrong a lot on their way to becoming right, or are becoming closer to right than they were before. So I think being wrong, as long as you don't stay there, and as long as you're not touting it as reality and making massive decisions based on it, isn't bad. You need to just always be progressing closer to being right.
I think, though, just I want to interject before I forget, that is the problem. I think a lot of people are saying, you know, if you disagree with science, then you're like a heretic or stupid, or that you kind of get outcasted. I think particularly in the field of academia, or, you know, the cutting edge stuff, if you don't agree with the mainstream theory, then you are kind of outcast and deemed ridiculous, I don't know. I'll stick with what I originally said. You're kind of outcast. And then if it's found out that they were right all along, you're a pariah. And if it's found out that they were right all along, they don't really get a redemption. And that's a problem, because that's why I'm saying it's bad either way, because the people who are doing the outcasting are the ones saying this ridiculous conclusion is true. So either this ridiculous conclusion is true, which throws a lot of our intuition right out the door, at least when it comes to the more fringe stuff. But it still does provide a counterexample to our intuition and indicating that, hey, we really have to be careful about how we apply our intuition, and maybe we're not as smart as we are. And it should really be a humbling situation to get people to say, this doesn't make sense to me, but that doesn't mean it's wrong, as opposed to what they do now, where they say, this doesn't make sense to me, ergo, I need to shut you down. So either that's what's going on, or the people who are doing the outcasting are all sold on a wrong idea and are now dominating the academia and industry based off of this false doctrine, which is bad.
It's bad wrong. Badong.
It's badong.
So we must stand for the opposite of bad wrong. Gnaw-dab.
Gnaw-dab.
And in doing so, I'm going to propose a challenge to all of the mind-bogglingly expert academics who listen to our podcast, which is that we do a meta study across the history, the recorded history of human science, and create an accuracy calculation for how often those doing the outcasting, as you said, you know what I mean, how often have they been right and how often have they been wrong? Or the person making a prediction, how often they've been right or wrong? Like, what is the actual predictive power of human science? With where somebody throws out a wacky theory, you're like, no, that can't possibly be correct, but it's a true positive, right? But 99% of the scientific establishment rejected it. And then where are those wacky theories? Was like, no, it actually is wacky and we rightly rejected it. Like, how good is the scientific establishment at predicting the reality of someone's conclusions? That would be fascinating.
I wonder if in that study we would find, kind of wrapping things back around, if we would find this weird correlation between, you know, the test is 90% accurate, but then for any given sample, you're only going to get about 10% of true results.
The whole conversation, though, about casting people out in pariahs, though, and things being unintuitive, got me thinking of another topic that I think is worth bringing up, because it's timely, and I haven't really heard a lot of people talking about it from this perspective. But I was just listening to a podcast yesterday on the topic of the German farmer protests. You heard of that?
No, I haven't.
So I think last year, so this would have been 2023, there were protests in like the Netherlands, farmers protesting, and they were like, I think actually like driving around with manure spreaders, like flinging poo on streets and maybe buildings in some cases, but they were protesting laws that they feel are overly restrictive, prevent them from being able to make a profit or even break even within farming. And so this is now happening in Germany, and I guess over the past week or few weeks, maybe it's longer ago now, I don't know the exact timeline, but there were literally tens of thousands of farmers who, and truckers and skilled trades and stuff, who had either semis or tractors on the roads in Berlin and like had roadblocks set up and just pretty much ground all road transportation to a halt for the same reasons.
Like in support of the farmers, or there were also regulations hurting their industries too?
Also regulations hurting their industries.
Okay.
So just to list a couple of examples, as it was explained in the podcast, so this is secondhand, thirdhand, or whatever at this point, but I think relatively accurate to the situation there. So and this is true, again, these two countries as examples, I think true across a lot of Europe and a lot of developed countries or cities that are very concerned about the environmental state of our planet, or the state of our planet's environment, however you want to say that. So one of the things is, because farming is so carbon intensive, the country wants to reduce the amount of land that's used to farm and wants to do more organic farming, et cetera. But so I think they said they want a 10% reduction in basically the land used to farm. The problem being, all the things being equal, let's say you reduce the amount of land being used to farm by 10%. That means you're producing 10% less food, but people eat the same amount, right?
Yeah.
So that food has to come from somewhere. So in the name of reducing the carbon emissions of Germany's farm economy, they're now going to have to import that food from somewhere. And if many of the nations in Europe are following these same protocols, that food is going to have to be imported from farther away. So number one, you have all the fuel that's now used to import the food. Number two, the countries that are taking the most action to reduce their carbon impact already have taken the most action. And so their production methods are the most efficient and cleanest production methods on the planet. So you're not only paying this an additional carbon footprint to import it, you know, transport food over a long distance. The food was also grown most likely in a very much more carbon intensive nation.
Mm-hmm.
So on the surface, it's like, hey, look, we're doing this good thing for the planet. Thumbs up for Germany. But in reality, the net effect for the planet is actually negative, because instead of the efficient or the carbon efficient German farmers producing the food near to where it's going to be consumed, you now have carbon inefficient farmers somewhere else producing the food, and then carbon inefficient transportation to get it there.
Right.
So that's just one example of many. The other one that they talked about was how Germany shuttered all of its or many, I don't know if it's completely all, but many of its nuclear power plants, to the point where they now have to import energy from other countries. And the part that's absolutely mind-boggling is they shuttered the nuclear plants and somehow are bringing coal plants back online. And I don't understand it, but somehow in the name of clean energy. And then this is a slightly different one, and it's more generic, but in a similar vein, I think growing up, my family always recycled, and that's something that I've always felt probably too much pride in, of like, oh, I'm doing my part, you know, like we're recycling what we can. But there are two problems with that. Number one, many of the things that we put in recycling can't actually be recycled, even for people, I think, who are being careful. And a lot of it depends on your local recycling handler, what they have access to as a wholesaler or whatever to get rid of it. So even things that are technically recyclable don't necessarily get recycled in your local area. So there's a lot that just ends up in the landfill, even that was designated for recycling. But then the other thing is, recycling is still the most invasive form of conservation, right? The phrase reduce, reuse, recycle. Recycle is supposed to be the third leg of that stool, and we've turned to it as if it's the solution. Mm. And the least energy intensive, least cost intensive options are to either reduce consumption of something, so just use less of it, and then you don't have to recycle as much or reuse as much, or like instead of using plastic containers, using glass or wood or whatever, where they can be reused over and over and over again, so they don't actually have to be remade. They're just more durable containers. So anyway, all that to say that we've kind of gotten sucked into this, like, oh, we're helping the planet by recycling, and so we don't feel bad about buying containers made of plastic all the time. So there's no pressure on manufacturers to produce things in more sustainable containers, because we're like, oh, recycling's the answer. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really help that much. So anyway, those were a couple of thoughts that came to mind in the whole like unintuitive realm, but that are also timely to current events.
Right. And it really speaks to the counterintuitiveness of, because again, like my example was of the, like the test case or of the disease test for Flargenstau. It could be like, well, maybe that's like a real quirky, one-time extreme example. But like what you're talking about, that's a pretty intuitive thing to just say we want to reduce, and that's something I think a lot of people can see happening in their regular daily lives. The government wants to cut carbon emissions. It's happening a lot. So, well, farmland produces a lot of carbon, so reduce farmland and food production. It's like, okay, I could see a lot of problems unrelated to carbon production, coming from that, but we'll just leave that alone for now. So we should reduce our carbon footprint. But you're right. Like, what they aren't accounting for is, well, the food's got to come from somewhere. And now it's coming from here. The important thing, as you said, is it's coming from places that aren't as carbon conscious as Germany. What Germany should really be doing, if they want to reduce the world's carbon footprint, is coming up with the most
Expanding.
efficient, yeah, is expanding their farming practices because they are the best or pretty good at low carbon farming techniques. Now you'd still have to ship the food, so, or maybe you're going to different countries and like in teaching them how to do low carbon stuff. But that takes
Although
work and effort and
the reason that whole farming topic was top of mind for the unintuitive, obviously I mentioned the podcast, but actually today I saw an article, I think it was like in a physics journal maybe, which seems odd, but anyway, the headline of the article was that the trend of like urban farming or like community gardens in a like a downtown area, whatever, that is 6 times more carbon intensive than traditional farming methods, like out in the field with a tractor farmer style. So I was just thinking about that of like, the people who tend to participate in that kind of like a communal shared effort to improve a community. Certainly there's part of it of like, it because you grew it kind of thing. So I'm not downplaying the benefits of doing it, but I think a lot of those people also would say that they care deeply about the environment and want to, reduce carbon emissions, whatever. And yet this thing that on its surface seems to be planet friendly, is actually perhaps not nearly as much as we thought.
Right. Very the world is counterintuitive, folks, which is why it's very important to be humble in your assumptions.
Yep. And I think it's just a reminder that, don't get me wrong, like their intellectual achievement collectively across societies and millennia is impressive. Like the accomplishments we've talked about a number of times on this podcast, inventions and improvements, etc. There's a lot there. So this is in no means to diminish that. But I think on the flip side, we also always have to take that with a grain of salt, that we're seeing a snapshot in time of what we believe is true and accurate, but we're always learning. And so there's, I think sometimes in today's day and age, there's become kind of this vocal mantra of, trust the science or whatever, that there is a single correct answer that we know today, and that we must adhere to whatever that is, almost at a religious level. And so for me, I think it's just we always have to think critically, not just academics, but all of us people in our everyday lives, of not just taking the things that we see at face value of like, oh, I put the recycling in the container. Obviously, it gets recycled, and obviously, that's good for the planet, right? Instead of just being the little mindless drone, dropping your stuff in the box and then going about your day, it's like, oh, is this actually achieving the effect that I'm intending?
Right. I think a lot of people, I actually have to go here in like 9 minutes ago, I realized, because I forgot that I have to eat dinner before my later engagement. But what I want to leave with is, I think it's easy, and I can certainly understand why people want to just say, here's the right answer. We found it. Yay, everybody. There's no more work that needs to be done, but just wishing it were so does not make it so. And believe it or not, Men in Black, the original Men in Black from the 90s, there's a line in that movie that is oddly philosophical given the style of movie. And it's Agent K is trying to reduce, not reduce, recruit Agent J. And I can't remember what Agent J says, but Agent K says, 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, everyone knew that the Earth was flat. 1,000 years ago, everyone knew that we were the center of the universe. And 15 minutes ago, you knew that you were alone on this planet. Imagine what we'll know tomorrow.
Ooh.
To put that
Yeah.
into context, people, it's about movies about aliens. Hence the "you knew you were 15 minutes ago. You knew you're alone on this planet." But yeah, it's just his, because he's like, it's almost like he's tired when he says, "Imagine what you will know tomorrow," because he knows what's coming, right? He knows that we're all going to get behind some 100% accredited fact, that we're all going to ostracize others for not believing, only to realize that we were wrong all along. And then we can't stop it. It's part of the human cycle.
Yeah, it's
Sucks.
true.
And if you want to break that human cycle, all you got to do is be humble, be considerate, and don't ostracize people for believing in something different than you, because history shows they got a good chance of being right, or at least you got a great chance of being wrong.
So if you really want to help us out, be humbled and maybe boost your self-confidence at the same time, do the meta study that I suggested. And figure out how predictive the scientific establishment is over the ages. And then tell us the results. We'll all be famous.
Should be pretty quick.
Yeah,
One
no
night's
doubt.
work at most.
You probably actually get it done while Jack's hurrying up and fixing himself some dinner. So get after it. With that, I want Jack to be able to eat. So we will end here. Thanks everybody for joining us. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Wow, what a guy.